Hi, my name's Tim Phillips and I'm on my way to Oxford today. I'm going to be bringing you a series of podcasts from the annual conference of the Structural Transformation and Economic Growth Programme.
The next train, platform 3, is the 1326 service to Oxford.
And, right on cue, there's my train. STEG is a research initiative that aims to provide a better understanding of structural change, productivity and growth in low and middle-income countries. In 2025, the fifth conference is being held in the Economics Department of the University of Oxford. As always, it incorporates an eclectic mix of presentations and keynotes on all aspects of structural change in developing economies. One of the keynote presenters this year is Robert Townsend of MIT, who throughout his career has studied the impact of financial systems, insurance, and credit in development. He chose the topic of digital technologies. Well, that's a big title. So, what does that include?
Yes, the first thing that comes to mind is payments.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about digitization, they think about the payments aspect, whether it's in China or Argentina or Indonesia, but there's much more to digital technology than just executing a payment transaction.
So for people who are wondering what sort of technologies you're talking about, could you give us a couple of examples?
Sure. You can write contracts and execute contracts on a digital platform.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about payments, there's like the level of the balance of the coin in your account, and a transaction is transferring the coin from one account to another for some purpose. But you have already the notion of the balance of coins across the different participants as being like the state of the ledgers across the participants.
Mm-hmm.
So the contracting comes with Ethereum. Ethereum is a node. The contract is a node, not a person, along with other transacting parties that are nodes. And that node works off the same principle of having a state variable. So you can enter into, say, a mutual risk-sharing arrangement, and the current state of the contract would be the escrowed balances in each person's account, and the transaction would be the transfer of value from someone who's been accumulating a lot of credits to someone who suffered an unfortunate accident and wanting the debits. Instead of taking the transaction in isolation as a payment of an indemnity to the insuree from the insurer, I'm embedding it in this larger picture of a contract where they've agreed ex ante to the rules that would determine who's supposed to pay the premium, who's supposed to get the indemnity, under what circumstance, what order of magnitude, and so on.
These are conversations that I have had in London, in New York, very often in the financial sector or the legal sector when they're talking about blockchain. It's unusual to be having that from a development economics point of view. What got you interested in this?
I had been doing a lot of work in Thailand for many years. It started with going into villages and doing field research, eventually led to a pretty large project funded by the Ford Foundation and then a little bit of Gates money and from the U.S. government, from the National Institute of Health. And we decided to see whether what I was finding in northern Thai villages was true of other regions of the country. There was a financial crisis, the 1997 devaluation,
mm-hmm.
and that led to the idea of going back to see what was happening in this shock. One thing led to another along a path I never could have imagined, and we ended up doing even monthly surveys for 20 years. And for those households, and many of them running small businesses, I have created with the transactions data that they report to us, their income statement, the statement of cash flow, and the balance sheet. So we have an enormous database in my terminology and lots of papers, you know, many published. And we could see what was working pretty well in those villages. For example, if they have family in the village, not just living in the, you know, kinship-related households through up to three generations or something, they tell us that they help each other, and you see it in the data. They literally give and get gifts from each other, or they provide zero interest rate loans. And in my data, I can see that's helping them to get through hard times, to smooth consumption. If they have an adverse shock, they're pooling their risks through this informal gift giving. On the other hand, if you're not fortunate to have kin in the village, you're pretty much on your own. You can save, squirrel the currency away for use in hard times, and they certainly do that. They don't manage the currency particularly well, but they do have kind of a buffer stock, but they're not beneficiary of these mutual risk-sharing systems. So to answer your question, I wanted to bring something back to these households that I'd been interviewing monthly for 20 years. And I was very confident I knew what they needed because you could see it in the data and they were telling us this. But I wasn't able to take the next step. Then the fintechs offering these new technologies seem to provide a pathway.
And so you're talking about the sort of problems that many of the fintechs, a lot of the innovation in financial services is trying to solve. However, they speak a somewhat different language to development economists, don't they?
Yes, but there's a lot of common interests. And so I've partnered with fintechs now. I did start in Thailand. I found a bit more success in Argentina with Mercado Pago, and in Indonesia with GoTo, and in China more indirectly with Alipay. I mean, there you have the advantage of their experience. You can learn what products they have offered in their history of innovation, how they think about the design of new products. Yes, and then we can bring to that partnership these frameworks that they're not necessarily familiar with. One thing that happens in these companies is you get sort of data silos, right? They're thinking, oh, we're offering a payment product. So that's that group over there and we have that database. Or we're offering this consumer finance product and that's a different group. And a third group is a small business loan. So that's the way some of the companies think about it naturally through products, right? You create a new innovative product. It doesn't always work for them either. I should say that it's not like they know in advance. You know, Mercado Pago will try out QR codes that were very successful in Argentina, less so in Chile, if I remember correctly. They learn from that experience. That's their business. It's the business of innovation to try out new things, which ultimately benefits the company, yes, but also can benefit the clients and SMEs.
So there's this huge potential for experimentation and innovation, and you've identified some of the pressing problems where this could really help development. One of those is supply chains of networks of people owing money to each other. What's the problem here?
The problem is partly that the formal financial system isn't reaching them or offers adverse high interest rates. So you sell a product, you're a small business, but you don't get paid right away. Well, better some sales than nothing. So you contract with the large buyer to be paid in 90 days. And often that could work quite well for both parties. It's a borrowing and lending arrangement. I'm far from taking a stand that borrowing and lending is a bad thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's an uneven playing field and the large buyer that could potentially pay is not paying on time. But setting aside the bilateral aspect, you have the multilateral aspect in a supply chain. Goods flow one way and money flows the other. If you're at a middle point on the line, so to speak, you're basically the buyer for inputs coming to you and the supplier of inputs for someone on the other side of you. And so you have both accounts payable and accounts receivable, but there are many, many nodes in practice in a chain, right? We can provide compelling examples and graphics of things like, for example, with three of them, A owes B, B owes C, and C owes A, and you can't settle that with a bilateral transaction. It has to be trilateral, where they all agree to settle the debts. In other words, you owe me, and I owe the other guy. So you're not getting the flow back when you pay your money, but you are owed money from somebody else. So one of the advantages of putting that information on a platform is that in principle, the platform can see all these interconnections and can handle this kind of gridlock problem.
That sort of shared ledger technology avoids people having to access expensive credit or just to keep substantial savings for themselves.
Yes, exactly. It allows kind of a mutualized netting, a very sophisticated algorithmic kind of netting that minimizes the amount of liquidity. Because if you have a chain, you know, from A to B to C to D to E, and they all have a balanced position of being owed one unit, but owing one unit, then that liquidity flows through the system. So great, I was owed money, it got paid, I got the liquidity, now I pay the person that I owe, and it flows all the way from A to Z, and all with the same unit of liquidity. So you get a huge multiplier in the reduction of the level of indebtedness in the system with a judicious use of a bit of extra liquidity.
Tell me a little bit more about the principle of risk sharing using these technologies.
The idea is that we all experience ups and downs. If you're a farmer, from adverse weather, droughts, and so on that make the harvest low, if not zero, or floods. And climate change, climate risk is a big factor for farmers. And it's also a factor for SMEs running businesses in cities, as well as other shocks, just personal illness and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, to put it boldly, is to enumerate shocks which have very large adverse consequences for individuals that don't happen very often. And when they happen only to a subset. Then you're really ripe for pooling that risk. Everybody's exposed to it ex ante, so they would like to have an inflow of funds if they experience the adverse event. But ex post, not many people experience the event. That's the hypothesis. And so the accumulated premia, accumulated in advance, are sufficient to allow substantial indemnities to cope with these really serious problems for the small subset of the population experiencing them.
What advantage is there for digital technologies in this above the existing insurance policies that they could access already?
The insurance picture is pretty mixed depending on the country. Some events are covered, some are covered by public provision. Sometimes public provision crowds out innovation by the private sector. The digitization may allow access to something they don't currently have. But even if they have some access to insurance through public or private providers, it may not be adequate enough. The digitization allows this contracting possibility that I mentioned before. Say you're dealing with people that don't know each other. So you don't trust the mutualization. It's like, okay, we both know one or the other of us is going to get hit with a shock, but we don't know who it's going to be. Let's agree and shake hands that if I have the bad shock, you'll pay me, or vice versa. And then the time comes and, you know, say, well, that's fine, but actually I don't really want to pay you. And there's no trust or family relationship to, you know, have them be more forward looking. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the digitization, in principle, they say, yeah, we would both benefit from this. So let's contribute our premia now and lock it up. So it's tokenized and put into escrow voluntarily. And then you have the liquidity in the system to pay out the indemnity. And also no hanky-panky with the way and the amount of money you're going to get. It's all in the code. Well, you can see this isn't just a low-income country problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking from a U.S. perspective, not to mention Britain, well, public health is a big issue.
Yeah.
And the insurance companies do have problems, and some make a lot of money, some are in trouble, but they're constantly trying to find margins that limit the outflows, right? Whereas in this case, you've got the thing codified. Everyone has agreed to the contract. There's no ambiguity about what's going to happen and under what circumstances. You know, you may learn from experience, and the parties may agree that next time around, they would tweak the contract in a different direction. But the execution of the current contract is not in doubt. So these technologies are a substitute for trust systems.
A big part of how the innovators in these technologies think about it is it's decentralized. not necessarily delivered by a government authority or even the traditional deliverers of, say, financial products. In these settings, in rural Thailand, for example, who's going to make this happen?
The private sector tends to be, in, say, Indonesia, the big innovator. With digital payments and now, you know, with credit and other contracts on top of it. But it is important that either people trust the provider or that the provider is providing information and access on a public platform. Mm-hmm. I think of what are useful public interventions, it's not necessarily having the government get into the nitty-gritty of providing the insurance contracts. Although that could happen and it could work. It's rather providing this public good, which is the infrastructure for contracting and interaction with free entry. So subject to some credentialing, financial service providers, not just commercial banks, could offer products to clients. And that's basically what Brazil is already doing. They went from Pix, which is a fast payment system, to Drex, which is a smart contracting wholesale platform run by the central bank, which is Ethereum based. And they did not design it based on their presumptions of what would work or what was needed. Mm-hmm. Rather, they invited the private sector to make proposals. And there was a little bit of back and forth. You know, if you're dealing with a central bank, it's like, well, what do you really want so that I know what to propose? But they got around that problem because they were genuine and they really did want to hear. So they formed working groups. I mean, they were inundated with proposals in the end. Mm-hmm. And they chose a variety in different areas in order to gain experience and had working groups for how what the private sector would like to do in terms of innovation could benefit from a wholesale CBDC run by the central bank. I was very fortunate to be part of this. I'm an advisor to the Bank of Brazil, and I was very happy to participate in these groups. I learned an enormous amount. I mean, that said, I think Brazil is way ahead of most countries.
Yeah.
There are a subset of countries that are very interested in doing something. We've formed a group at MIT under my lab, Laboratory for Economic Analysis and Design. And now we've been funded by a grant from the German aid agency to precisely make contact with, have conversations with, and have joint workshops with central banks from low and middle income countries. So I know there's interest out there. I wouldn't say that it's universal. And for sure, there's a lot of questions and a lot of misunderstandings about what this technology can do. And there's different situations in different countries. Not one size should fit all. Ideally, you will find out what the problem, what are the underlying real obstacles, the pain points, and if the political climate within the country permits it, then you can imagine designing and implementing improved financial systems for individual countries.
This isn't a topic that very many economists are fully embedded in the way that you are. Would you recommend this as a useful way to do research, to learn more about how to solve the problems of the people that you're thinking about?
Totally would recommend it, not just because I do it, but because I see huge opportunities. And also the scope and scale of ultimately what would be needed is large. And this will require collaborations. Mm-hmm. I enjoy being here at this conference setting in Oxford today because there's a group of researchers here who are very serious about structural transformations and assessing impact and helping to guide policy. And I'm pointing out to them that one of the structural transformations underway is digitization. At a minimum, we will benefit from learning about what each other is doing. That's the purpose of a standard academic conference. But it can go beyond that to genuine collaborations with individual researchers. I do think these things are going to inherently need people from multiple fields, in particular an alliance and partnership with computer scientists. If you were to ask me what I think is the single most helpful thing that I've done to build on my experience in Thailand, it would be to find collaborators in computer science who are not politicized with the hype of decentralization, but are very interested in economic applications. That's a wonderful marriage.
Well, let's hope more of those marriages come to pass, Robert. Thank you very much.
Thank you for helping and sharing today. I appreciate it.
If you want to read more, then Robert literally wrote the book on this. It is called Distributed Ledgers, Design and Regulation of Financial Infrastructure and Payment Systems, and it was published by MIT Press in 2020. He has also published extensively on the wider topics we discussed, particularly his work in Thailand.